Welcome to the Diecast, everybody. I'm Seamus. With me this week is Mumbles.
Hey, everybody.
And Josh.
The thought that this podcast might one day answer emails, it fills you with determination.
And also Christopher Campster.
Hello.
All right. And this week, we're going to talk about Beginner's Guide. I sort of already talked about this a bit on Twitter, which was awkward. I realized, this is a terrible format for discussing such a complex game. Maybe I should shut up and save this for the podcast that we do.
We should also probably point out that we're probably going to get into spoilers here, so if that's important, you might want
to
skip ahead.
Difficult to talk about. So this has been a weird fucking month for video games. This has been a really weird, really good fucking month. You've got Beginner's Guide, you got Soma, and you got Undertale all within a month of each other, and we might talk about all of them on this podcast. Who knows?
And Sub-Level Zero.
Which... nobody here played except Seamus, but
and Happy Home Academy.
What is that?
It's an Animal Crossing game. We talked about it.
We did already. Damn it.
did we not? I know you and I talked about it. I don't know if it made it to the diecast. It's an Animal Crossing game. We're getting off topic.
Anyway,
Beginner's Guide. Okay, we're gonna have to spoil this game to talk about it. The game is only 2 hours long. But here's the premise. It's by the guy who made the Stanley Parable. And he opens up the game by saying, "Hi, I'm the guy that made the Stanley Parable." And he's actually narrating directly to you. He's like, "I had a friend, Coda, who used to make video games." I think it was like, it was Source Engine games. Like, Coda would just churn out these little Source Engine concept games. And this guy would play them. And then one day, Coda stopped making games, and he wants Coda to make games again, so he's taken all of Coda's games and strung them together into this one game, and he's gonna let you play through them and discuss each of them. So it's a sort of this really weird meta let's play thing where the developer is giving you commentary while you play through somebody else's game. There are just so many levels deep there. That and alone is a pretty weird concept.
it's really, really interesting, and it was really clever. Like, we should also add that there's another level here, because like it's pretty clear by the end that Coda either never existed. Notably, his name is spelled Coda, as in a Coda.
Her name.
or her name. I thought it was a him.
Nope. I think that, okay, first of all, I think that Coda isn't real, and I think that when the game first came out for like a week, people were trying to figure out if Coda was a real person, and if so, they were outraged that Davey would put out a game that has his or her work in it. So let's just say, for the point of discussion, she's not real. If she was in the context of the game, she may not be real even there. But in the context of real life, she's not real. Because if we get into a conversation about whether or not she is real, it's not going to work out. And there's no way that she is. There's absolutely no way.
I suppose it's possible that Coda is based on a real person, but obviously it's not Coda's work really in the game, because that's like, you know, think about that for 2 seconds, legally, like, ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly. The idea is that Coda would share this with his or her. I always thought Coda was a guy, but I don't remember him ever saying him. So
here's why I think it's a girl, because he does say Coda, he does call him, but, whenever you play one of the games, the player character is always a woman. And the relationship that he has with Coda seems like a male-female relationship. And on top
like
of that...
kind of a creepy
exactly.
Stalkerish, really? Yeah.
And the way that she talks to him at the end of the game, with the slides of speaking, or big walls of text or whatever... It sounds like a woman telling a guy to back the fuck off. And I've
yes,
heard
it does.
Women use that same kind of language, and I've personally used that kind of language. So I think that Coda is a female. I think that since at the end of the game, you realize that Davey's been inserting his own shit into these games.
Yeah.
And you're not really sure where Davey starts and where Coda starts. Like, you don't know what is her game and what is his game. And so it would make sense that he would start calling Coda he, because he's obviously seeing these game, the character, not the real Davey. He's obviously seeing these games as his and not necessarily hers.
This is some Stephen Colbert shit. Stephen Colbert, the character talking about Stephen Colbert, the actor, kind of level of, wait a minute, which voice are we? There's like the in-game Davey, there's the game developer Davey, and then there's the Davey you meet in the game that both speak in the exact same voice, except they have opposing points of view, and it gets really deep. And you start wondering which one, you start trying to puzzle your way through it. Before we spoil any more, I'll recommend this game. I highly recommend this game as sort of a goofy, okay, yes, it's a walking simulator, total walking simulator. If you're looking to be challenged, no, this is not that game. But if you just want something really weird and goofy, like the Stanley Parable, something that'll kind of make you think and kind of tell a little weird story, then sure, get this game. You can consume it quickly, and it's very, very thought-provoking, especially if you're at all interested in game development. I should have said this at the beginning of this segment. I'm sorry. Continue, Josh.
Well, that's definitely the most clever thing that the game does, is it takes Davey, the real person, and folds him into the game ostensibly, initially as a real person, but very clearly as a fictional character itself into the fictional narrative. So you start with this pretense of like, oh, this is a true story, and then you start to realize as you go through it, oh, this is actually a game story. Yeah.
And I didn't realize it was fiction until way late. Until very late. And in fact, even after the game was over, I was still a little bit unclear. And what solidified it for me was somebody pointed out the, very early, he's showing you one of Coda's levels, and he's like, yeah, and here's this jail level. Now, in Coda's original design, you went in this jail cell, and then you just had to wait for an hour before the cell would open again. Of course, I'm not going to make you wait that long, so I'll just open the door for you now. And that was a very Stanley Parable moment. Like, that was obviously something from the mind of the person who wrote the Stanley Parable, which is Davey, attributing this ridiculous concept to somebody else. And so, it's like other people have said, Coda writes in the voice of Davey a lot of the time, or vice versa.
The most interesting thing to me about the Beginner's Guide isn't actually the game itself, but watching how everybody else has been reacting to it and the context that people have been reacting to it. Like, Hamster and I were talking about it shortly after we both played it, about 2 weeks ago, and we were kind of talking about it in terms of, literary criticism, sort of. Like, it's a commentary about, interpreting works. But I also, was looking on your Twitter, Seamus, and you were interpreting it as, you were seeing it in the context of a game developer, of a game about making games. And Mumbles, just a few minutes ago, contextualized it as a game about,
relationships.
Creepy stalker and relationships and that kind of
thing. Yeah.
I think that's the most interesting thing about the Beginner's Guide, is how everybody else is seeing it through their own lens.
Yeah, I think it's I think it's a good way of like showing what we all sort of zone in on pretty easily when it comes to games, and a lot of our spoiler warning seasons end up being like that, where we all tend to see it kind of the same, and it falls in the same line.
I also thought that the areas themselves were so goofy and strange that they were interesting. It's like stuff you've never seen in a game before. If you like just seeing weird levels and just walking through crazy scenery, this is also a good game. It's like, hey, you're on some sort of Halo 1 looking spaceship. Oh, and now we're in a cafe. Oh, and now we're in this big abstract floating platform thing. Oh, and now we're in kind of a modern office. Oh, and now we're in a Counter-Strike level. And it's just this constant, almost dizzying jumping from one thing to another just to do a few comments on the work Coda is doing. And whether Coda is real or not, it tells the story of like, oh, here Coda comes up with an idea and then makes several of these little game, they're not games, they're sort of like one level of gameplay ideas. And it's the same idea iterated on several times, which is really interesting to me as a game developer. I mean, you know, when you iterate on an idea, you end up with one idea at the end. But then there's the 10 ideas you left behind while you were iterating.
And sort of lot of those ideas, like, tend to kind of fall in line with that one idea. Like, I was listening to a poet the other day talk about, they have this monthly, it's sort of like National Write a Book Day or whatever, but the difference is every day you write a poem. And so she decided to participate, and every day she wrote a poem, and she was like, oh, look how productive I am. I can't believe I do this all the time. And then she looked at each one of the poems, and each poem was trying to say the same thing over and over and over again. And it was her just trying to come to the same, like, conclusion. It just took a while. And I think the thing I like about this game is that it's not just about games, it's about the creative process and how a lot of the times you can kind of circle a drain until you kind of figure out like what you want to do and get rid of ideas that don't work or whatever. And I think like that's what a lot of the game seems to be about.
Like the final version of the idea, but it's really interesting in sort of an archaeological sense to look at the earlier versions of an idea. Kind of like people love looking at the earlier versions of, say, Half-Life 1, where it had Ivan the Space Biker, and you're like, what? How did this become Half-Life 1? Like, that arc is really interesting, and we never get to see all the previous versions of a game that existed before the final version of a game. And that is, so this feels like you're drawing back the curtain and seeing how sausage is made, which is kind of interesting.
Did Camster get muted? Or
no, I'm here. Hi.
I figured you'd have something to say about the beginner's guide.
Oh, I have lots to say. It's just bizarre.
Chris, say something about beginner's guide.
I was deeply perturbed by playing the beginner's guide. So
that's fair. That's fair. I think that's a totally fair rendering of it.
Well, I was too.
It's just, the whole time I could not escape the feeling that I was playing through that Blendo Games episode I made, because like it starts with a, you know, hey, here's a guy making a mod level for an established game, and then slowly they start making their own things, and we're just going to iterate over everything they've ever done over time and give commentary to it. And it just was a very surreal sense of deja vu, like I was looking at an errand signal from another dimension, and it really creeped me out. Especially as the heel turn starts and you start realizing that it's the commentator that's the antagonist. And that didn't feel so good.
Oh, Camster. I didn't even notice that. I think I was so just interested in the way that he talked about Coda and how he felt about games that I didn't notice that it was sort of... it was exactly like that video that you made. And so I went back and watched your Blendo video, and it scared the shit out of me. Like, I couldn't even get through your whole video because I was like, oh my god.
I'm gonna link that episode in the show notes just to complete the circle of creepy.
What if Camster is Coda?
No, I'm not Coda. It was just a bizarre feeling, especially once you realize that the guy giving the commentary is sort of the antagonist of the whole thing. And It really made me introspect a lot of how much baggage I bring into my commentary on games. I mean, like Josh was saying, the big takeaway I got from it was that it was very much trying to make it clear that I think if Stanley Parable is about the relationship between player and game, and about how games give you choice, but the player wants power and control over those choices, I think this game is largely about the relationship between the author and the audience, and how much you actually really get to know somebody by playing their stuff, and how much of that is baggage you're bringing into a work versus how much of them is really innately in there.
Right, when Davey starts ascribing, it starts making all these logical leaps. Oh, I think Coda was saying this, and you're like, what? Why would you think, oh, that's actually your problem?
Yeah, no, there's this one part of the game where you go into this house and there's an NPC that gives you chores to do, and then you keep doing chores, and Davey is like, this is the nicest one. I'm just so glad that he finally got the chance to make this game and finally found some peace, and it's just really important to me. Of course, I changed some of it, you know, so you don't have to keep doing the same chore over and over again, but, you know, I'm just real glad. And I was like, oh my god, like, it's just your problem, dude. It is your fucking problem.
That game is specifically named by Coda in the end as, I don't remember exactly what they said about it, but, like, you know, stop changing the, you know, the...
Mm-hmm.
Well,
the chore game or something.
There's a motif, which is that that... Davey, not Davey, fake Davey, whatever you want to call him, is bringing meaning into games, and the motif that they use is bringing win states into the games. He gives them meaning by giving them closure. He gives them a purpose. You know, what was just this sort of thing that just loops forever and is basically a prison game, you know, he turns into a game that can be beaten if you just, you know, hack it, or if he gives you the answer, etc.
And, the other thing is that by the end of the game, Davey kind of makes it about how Coda's making these games, but not to make them playable or to get any recognition or to get anyone to tell him or tell her that she likes the games or anything like that. Coda is making these games just because maybe she just likes making prison games. And Davey says, I don't understand that. I make games because I want people to play them. And I need people to tell me that I'm doing a good job. And I thought that was a really interesting point.
And you can tell that that's not the voice of real Davey, because the person who made the Stanley Parable would not say that.
Yeah.
That's the Stephen Colbert sort of playing your own antagonist thing.
Yeah. The real Davey, and this is so easy for me to, like, the whole, like, real Davey, not Davey thing is easy for me to comprehend because I watch wrestling. Because in wrestling, the real guy, the real Undertaker is different from fake Undertaker. Anyway, so the real Davey wrote an article, I think maybe like a year ago. I don't know. I don't think it's that recent. And he said that after Stanley Parable came out, he started to just get a bunch of people trying to, like, talk to him and either get his advice or tell him that he sucked or, like, tell him that he was awesome and this game changes their lives or whatever. And at first he tried to engage with all of these people, but after a while he just couldn't. And he didn't know what to do, and he didn't know how to, like, handle having a game be that popular and be that much of a hit, and he's the only guy that fucking made it. And it's like, it's a kind of interesting thing to think about, too.
There is William Pugh, it should be pointed out.
Huh?
What?
Huh? There were two guys that made the Stanley Parable, William Pugh and Davey Reedon.
Yeah, but, like, he's the guy that we all think about. So I wonder if that's another thing to go along with Beginner's Guide, because I don't really think about the other guy. I always think about Davey. So, I don't know.
You know what? I could seriously talk about this game for the entire show, but we spend a third of this show, and for some, and a lot of people, just because this is a weird, quirky indie game, I don't want to push our luck with that too much, because a lot of people aren't going to play it.
If you haven't played it, and, you know, somehow you managed to not listen to us just talk about it for the past 20 minutes, go play it.
And then come back and listen to the previous
one. It's kind of, I think it's not a fun game. It's not a good game. It's an important
game. It's a good game.
And an interesting game.
It's a good game. I don't think it's fair to say that it's not a good game. It is a good game.
Well, I mean, it doesn't, like, it doesn't fit the adjectives you normally apply to video games, because
right.
it's not that
fun.
Sort of thing.
It's not yeah. fun
oh,
and
my
challenging.
God.
It's not.
Sorry,
the,
it's not a toy.
It's, I don't mind it being sort of obtuse and goofy and maybe a little bit arty and navel-gazy. That's all fine because it's super, you know, you can consume it in 2 hours, and that's exactly the right length
yeah,
for this idea.
Exactly.
If he was like, oh, 2 hours is not the right length for a game, I need to stretch this out to 4 hours because that's the accepted length for an indie game of this price point, it would have been awful. And somewhere around, you know, 2 hours and 15 minutes, we would all been like, all right, I've had enough of this bullshit.
Yeah.
So it makes a case for, yeah, sometimes games can be short and that's okay. But now let's talk about Soma. So Soma is by the people who made Amnesia, The Dark Descent, one of my favorite games.
Not a Machine for Pig, notably. This was the game they were making while Chinese Room did Machine for Pigs.
Not a Machine. Okay, yeah. So Frictional. Frictional, they started off with Penumbra, which if you go back and play Penumbra, you can see the beginnings of Amnesia, and you can even see the beginnings of, you can see, like, the team that would become the Frictional that we know today. It's not a great game. I don't highly recommend it. It's
sort of cheesy, almost.
Yeah.
Like, they're demonic dogs and, like, spiders and shit. There's, like, a really lame combat system in the first game.
That barely works and would be better if the... I think they were just afraid. I think they were afraid. They were like, well, we've got to have combat. You can't have a game with no combat. And then people... Then when Penumbra came out, people were like, this game would be better without the combat. And they were like, huh, I wonder if we could get away with that. And they did it in Amnesia.
Especially since you had the problem where it made it so that you could just, like, go stand on top of a box and then beat the monsters to death.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. You could just cheese it. And so that really, and that's what made their game good, is they would like took out this idea of, what if our game wasn't about defeating monsters? What if it was actually about hiding and being afraid of monsters? And what if we didn't have the mechanics and the gameplay, you know, the mechanics and the story completely at odds with each other, like you do in most survival horror games, where it's like, oh no, a spooky monster, you're gonna have to use one of your 3 shotguns on it, you know? So
then Midget Napoleon showed up and,
oh, don't get me started on that. So Soma is their latest game, and this one is okay. They've moved away from their I guess historical setting. Like, I think Amnesia was set vaguely Victorian or just a little pre-Victorian.
It was set in the 19th century sometime, like late 19th, like, well, not late, it was mid 19th century, something like that, like 1820s or 30s or 40s.
Yeah.
So a little bit before Victorian era, but yeah. And they've moved to, the future, actually. I don't know. I mean, we're going to spoil this game. So, and they moved to a science fiction setting, and it's actually very reminiscent of System Shock Underwater, which sounds familiar for some reason. I don't really recall. But
I wonder if they made a game like that. They should, but with shotguns.
Yeah. Yeah, and maybe like I shouldn't call it System Shock. It should be like Life Shock or
yeah,
something.
Good
I don't
one.
Know. That's ridiculous.
Yeah.
But it's, they moved into a sci-fi, setting and actually sort of moved away from the horror genre in general, which is probably the biggest problem of the game that we'll get into in a minute. But the game very heavily draws from like 50s and 60s, science fiction, like Philip K. Dick kind of stuff, and it's really, really good, except for the parts where it's trying to be Amnesia, which is unfortunate because it front loads a lot of that.
I'm maybe a third of the way through, and I'm not enjoying it. And
yeah.
To be fair, like, when I encountered the first monster, I tried to electrocute it, which was about 20 minutes of my time wasted trying to electrocute a monster. But that's not the fall of the game. That's me trying to be aggressive when apparently I'm not supposed to be aggressive. I'm not really charmed by it, partially because the main character makes a lot of dumb choices. A lot of dumb choices.
That goes throughout
the
end of the game.
Even early on in the game.
Yeah,
okay,
that's...
cool. Because, like, early on in the game, like, he sits down in a chair. There's someone who's like, can I spoil it a little bit? It's not a huge spoiler.
Yeah, yeah, let's go into the premise here.
So he has brain damage, and so he goes to a guy who says that he can, like, take a brain scan and, like, fix his brain damage or whatever. And so when he goes to meet this guy, the office is completely bare and ramshackled, and he's like, it's probably still fine. He, like, has to figure out a way to get inside himself. The receptionist isn't there. And when he does get in the back, it's super creepy. And it turns out the guy who's operating on his brain isn't even a real fucking doctor. So, like, at that point for me, I'd be like,
computer science student.
Weird building, creepy atmosphere, you're not even a doctor. You know what? I'm out of here. I'll see you later. Goodbye. But instead, he sits in the chair anyway, and then gets transported into this underwater facility. And from that point, he just keeps making bad choices. Like, as far as just sticking his hand and stuff, he probably shouldn't be sticking his hand in, and, like, I don't know. I, for me, playing a protagonist that is that fucking stupid kind of bugs me. Unless, like, it was a joke, but it's not a joke, I don't think. Or, I mean, unless it's the point of the game that he's a fucking dumbass.
It's kind of a plot point that he's willfully ignorant about what's going on around him. That's something that bothered a lot of people, I found. That he's just like one notch too stupid for what's going on to be believable. So yeah, you get a brain scan, and then instead of, you know, coming out of the brain scan, you wake up in a similar looking chair in an underwater facility, like a sci-fi underwater base, and everything's going wrong and there are monsters. And in much the same way that you sort of see Penumbra as the sort of transitionary phase for Frictional, the, like, we want to do a horror game, but we're not sure we can do a horror game without you know, weapons and killing and fighting monsters without combat. I look at Soma and I see a game where we want to do a sci-fi sort of horror game, but we're not sure we can do it without having monsters sometimes. So you get into situations where monsters show up and you have to hide from them, and it's just kind of a chore. There are points where it is kind of scary, but it's like the story is compelling enough, and what's going on around you is more interesting than like, oh, there's a monster now, that most of the time I ended up feeling like, oh good, the monster's here, I have to get this out of the way before I can get more, you know, story goodness.
It is weird how, even though all the monster encounters are more or less the same thing, because they're all built on the Amnesia style, like, monster shows up, don't look at it, hide and cower in a corner until it goes away. How varied my experience was with them. Some of them were legit as scary as Amnesia. Some of them were about as scary as Alien Isolation. Like, scary, but more tense than scary. And then some of them were just straight up irritating. Just sort of like, all right, yep. I just go. I gotta get to the door. And it's weird because they are
Do
all the same
mind,
mechanics.
Do you mind, monster? I'm in a hurry. You're wasting my time.
Yeah.
Stop growling at the wall and just get back to your patrol.
Actually, the worst monster was was, come on, monster, get the fuck out of the... No, you're standing in the one corridor I have to go through, and you won't leave! Go away! That was the most irritating.
Yeah.
There was a comedy moment for me where there's one that was guarding a box of... You need this battery.
Yeah, and that's the monster, one I'm speaking of specifically.
This one is there, right there, guarding this box that you need to get. And I've been all over the facility. I know I need this thing in front of the monster, and it's not moving. It's not patrolling. And so I'm like, if I get closer. All right, I'm standing right here. And it's clearly like my screen's freaking out. This is dangerous. I'm not supposed to be here. And it's still not moving. So fine. I run around the corner and jump up and down real loud. Monster still doesn't move. All right, well, I'll throw an object. Monster still doesn't move. So then I gather up a bunch of shit and I pelt the monster with trash and it still doesn't friggin' move. And by this time, we are so far away from anything remotely scary. The very idea of being scared by this moronic monster that I'm pelting with garbage while it goes, I feel like I'm picking on the dumb kid. I feel like I'm the bully. And the monster isn't bright enough to do anything but about it. And it is just completely destroyed. It, not only has it blocked my progress, but it completely destroyed the fear of the game, like almost from that point on. Like, it was so hard to get back into the game.
Yeah, no, that's basically what happened to me. With the first monster, there's this part where he walks into this little tiny area, and at the top of the area, up the stairs, is some water. And the monster's made out of, like, electronics and shit, and there's a place to hide up there, so I'm like, I'm gonna kill it. I'll kill it! That's what you're supposed to do, right? Just murder the monster, I'll put it in the water, the electronics will fizzle out, it'll die. And so I would, like, keep pelting boots at it. I was like, monster, this way, come on, let's go. And, like, it was so short-sighted, so it would, like, kind of go closer and then stop me, like, I don't know what was harassing me, what's going on, I'm scared. And I'm like, monster, fuck it. And then I would, like, throw, like, bins at it and shit. And then finally I got it to get closer, and I ran up the stairs and hid. And then, of course, it, like, got halfway up the stairs and then stopped and was like, well, I guess whatever ran up there is gone now. And then walked back down the stairs, and I was like, fuck! And I was like, this probably isn't what I'm supposed to be doing. Goodbye, 20 minutes
well,
of
no,
my life.
Well, no, the staircase you were supposed to go up was, like, 2 feet away from the switch that you flipped to bring it up there in the first place.
I wanted to kill it, Josh! I wanted to murder it, and it didn't let me.
Did you try standing on its head?
No, but I'll try that next time. The thing that I do like about Soma, though, is you do kill stuff. You kill shit, but when you kill it, it's real sad and fucked up, because, like, for example, there's this part where you need power for your train or whatever, and so you walk back to, there's like, oh, there's something sucking up all the power, so you walk back, and there's, like, this chick, and she, the only thing keeping her alive is this, like, electronic thing, like, consuming her. And you're like, yeah, so I'm gonna need to unplug you now. And you're like, unplug one. And she's like, ah, stop it, I'll die. And you're like, yeah, I'm still gonna unplug the next one. It's just like murder. It's a murder.
Did you know
simulator.
That you don't actually have to unplug both of those to progress? You can just unplug one.
What? Oh, yeah. I guess I just enjoyed it too much.
The game does that to you at a couple of points where you can just be... It's not like you're racking up Paragon or Renegade points. It simply allows you to do things and allows you to face the consequences. And you might not have even known there are a couple people that you can kill that they are the most direct and expedient way of meeting your goals. But if you're willing to work, you can avoid hurting them.
Oh, I just like killing them because it was funny.
Some where you can't not kill
right.
them, which is kind
right.
of annoying.
Like, oh, there's a robot guy. This is my favorite thing. There's a robot guy, and if you flip a switch, it causes him a lot of pain. And I don't know if it actually kills him or not, but I remember flipping the switch and just standing there going, all right, I'm done. And then I'd walk a couple of feet and I'm like, you know what? I'm going to do it again. And then I'd flip the switch again. He's like, no! Stop it! And I was like, this is amusing.
But before we... Okay, we're crapping on this game a lot. My overall take on it is that, yeah, it's not nearly as scary as Amnesia, but it's a really good bit of fiction. And this is the worst thing to say. Yeah, it's fantastic fiction, but I know that how obnoxious this is, but I gotta say it. You gotta wait for it to get good. And if somebody says, you know what, I don't want to play 2 hours of shitty video game to get to the good part, that makes sense to me. You shouldn't have to do that. But if you are willing to do that, there's some really good fiction in there. And it takes a while to get going for it to get all the pieces in place. And I honestly don't know why the intro is so slow. Like, there's this whole thing where your character isn't even... thinks that he's a guy from Toronto that was transported to the future. And I guess he thinks he's a time traveler. And it should be painfully obvious once you're into the game what's really going on. But the main character is super slow to figure it out. And the game spends about an hour with you in this state where you know what's going on and the main character doesn't. And he keeps, like, saying stupid shit and annoying you.
You know those scenes in horror or in zombie movies where the zombies show up and everyone's like, I don't understand. He got sick and I thought he was dead. Then he got up and bit somebody. Yeah. You know, and I don't even have a name for something like this. And it's just like, it's zombies. Yeah. They're zombies. We know what this is. It's zombies.
Right. You know what's going on. This character doesn't. And that moment should not have lasted nearly as long as it did. It lasted way too long.
It lasts until basically the end of the game.
You get that a few hours, a couple hours
it lasts to the end credits.
Yeah, he never really totally gets it, but the really annoying thing where he keeps wanting to, like, go back home or something is just, like, the completely obnoxious thing where he's slow to figure out what's going on. That lasted way too long. Once you get past that, the game gets much better. Once it finally settles down and starts telling the story of the arc is where I think it clicks. And you start thinking about the arc and about Catherine, and that's where it gets interesting. And Catherine starts asking questions. She stops being just a quest dispenser, and she starts wondering about, what does this mean for you and for me? And that's where it became a really good bit of fiction, and I enjoyed it a lot.
The back half is undeniably more strong than the first half, but I'm really torn on the game. I enjoyed it overall. I mean, if you really dig spooky but not necessarily super scary games, and if you dig Philip K. Dick style stories, I'd recommend it still. But I'm really torn on it, in part because, first of all, it asks a lot of your suspension of disbelief. Like, it hurls thing after thing after thing where, like, you could make an entire movie out of any one of those things, and it has like five or six of them. Like, okay, so there's a brain scan technology that records human minds for mapping. Check. And there's an underwater lab that is like a sea lab that is used to fire satellites into space in the distant future 2021. Check. Or not 2021. 2100.
If you're looking for me, you better check underneath the sea. That is where you'll find me. Sorry.
but then there's a comet that kills all life on Earth except the people under the sea. And then, and that's just like a footnote, like just the apocalypse happened above the ground and we don't even worry about that. And then there is an AI that is slowly taking over the station. And there is the ability to put these brain scans in the robot bodies. And the people don't know they're robots when you put them in the body, which is the robot that Mumbles was saying was in pain. It thought it was a person, and it begs you to kill it or get a doctor, and it doesn't know that it's a robot. And there's all of this going on, and it's just like... In the first hour, you're met with all of that. And then, like, eventually it starts going in interesting thematic directions. But that first hour is like, okay, wait, everyone's dead? And I'm not in Toronto, And this guy's a robot, and
I may not even be me. I may be some. I might be a brain scan. I may not even be a person anymore. Like, that kind of shit.
And if I'm not me, then what is this body I'm walking around on? It stretches that mystery out for a long time. Like, what is this body that I'm wearing? And the answer, I think, is kind of interesting, but what you think the answer is actually really banal. So it takes this entire concept a while to pay off. So yeah, it just takes the game so long to get, and I don't see any reason for it. Like, I don't know why the beginning had to be that slow.
It feels like they had to establish all the crap they wanted to do, because I think it all ties together in the end. Like, even the fact that it is not a very scary game, but it is a horror game, I think the fact that it's a horror game makes sense, given that they are trying to go for this sort of cosmic existential dread.
Otherwise, it'd be a walking simulator, and, like, I think you just need to start avoiding shit like that recently. If you make a game where you just walk around, it might still be a good game, but you're always going to get people telling you that it's not a game. And that's always going to be a discussion. And you don't want that. And it's just better to make a game where you have to hide from monsters so no one can be like, this isn't a game, there's no game mechanics, blah, blah, blah.
I loved it, but I loved it because it's a great piece of fiction, not because it's a really good scary game. It's actually a very middling scary game.
I just wish it got into some of the more discussions, like... Discussions between Catherine and Simon really needed to go more in depth, and they kind of like lightly tap on the metaphysics, but they don't really get into anything else. And
I really wanted a dialogue wheel like Mass. I rarely ask for that, but I really wanted a Mass Effect dialogue wheel. Like, let me ask questions at my own pace. Kind of, I want to sit here and explore this idea. All right, so that's only two games we managed to talk about. Let's try and do at least one more before this show comes crashing to a halt.
Can we talk about Undertale? Just a bit.
Yeah, do it. I have not played Undertale. I have it installed, but I've been playing Mass Effect 3 this week, and everybody here knows why, so I don't need to explain, but I've been playing Mass Effect 3 and writing... I know. We're almost there. I'm halfway done with Mass Effect 3. So, you guys just talk about... Is this going to be a spoilery conversation? Do I need to listen? Do I need to tune out?
Okay, well, do the spoiler-free part. Well, because there's something really interesting that I've been dying to talk about that I just recently discovered. Okay, so basically Undertale is an indie game that is very similar to Earthbound. It's very, very similar, and it's this game where basically the monsters and the humans were friends once, but then they got into a fight, and all the monsters were banished underground. And you're a little kid who fell underground and now has to find a way back up to the surface. And as the story unfolds, you realize that there used to be another little kid who died and was brought back to the humans, and then the humans thought that the monster killed the little kid, but the little kid just got sick or whatever, and killed that monster, and that brought so much hopelessness to the monsters who lived underground, and so now they have to collect human souls to try and break the barrier so they can go back into the light outside and probably start a war with the humans. And that's the premise of the game. And as the game unfolds, you realize that, like, not all of that story you heard is true, that maybe the first little kid that dropped down wanted to start a war with the humans, maybe tried to fuse his soul with a monster to try and, like, instigate humans into attacking them. And it's more of a game about how you can perceive a game a certain way, but if you play it differently, the game is completely fucking different. And it's trying to do what BioWare has been trying to do for the last, I don't know, 10 years or so, and it does it flawlessly. It's you can play through the entire game as a pacifist run, which means you don't kill anything. You can attack stuff, but as long as you don't kill anything, I think that's good enough. And you basically try and fix things and resolve things by being a friend to people and helping people out. And so you get to the end of the game, if you've played it all the way through that way, when you get to the end of the game, the game tells you that that's not it. And for me, that was like really, that really pissed me off, but that was the real point of the game. And then you realize that the game is playing around with save files. So if you played through the game the first time and killed a bunch of people, the game remembers that you killed a bunch of people. So even if you restart the game, it remembers that you had finished the game killing everyone. And it treats you that way. And I thought that was really interesting. And it's one of the first games that I've played where you can completely pacifist.
The game does some really, really crazy, like mind-boggling stuff with save states, where like it's there is a character in the game whose entire premise is that it knows that it's a character in the game and can manipulate game save states.
It has its own save state too.
And the
So you're
game
con- yeah.
acknowledges that you are a player of the game and remember things from previous save states that, didn't happen now. Jaren wrote a review where he couldn't figure out how to get past the first boss without killing her, so he killed her. Felt really bad about it, reloaded the save, found a way to not kill her, and then you run into this character that pops up through the game that is the one I was talking about that knows about these save states, and it basically said, you killed her, and then you felt bad about it, so you undid it, you idiot. And like it's like, well, holy crap, where did this game come from? This game is really good. You should play it.
It has really amazing music. I went to the gym today and I probably listened to the soundtrack through most of my workout. Really awesome music. Really, really fucking awesome. And the other thing that I really like about it is, so I played the pacifist run, ultimate good ending, all that shit, but I was really, really curious about the genocide run. For the genocide run, you have to kill every single character and you have to kill monsters until they stop spawning. And I was like, this sounds really interesting. I'd never do it, but it sounds really interesting. So I was watching a Let's Play of it. And then towards the end, one of the characters pops up and goes, "You and me, we can do anything. We'll kill people. We just want to see what the ending is. Not like those sickos out there that's probably just watching this on a YouTube channel to see what the ending is because they're too afraid to do it themselves." And you're like, "Oh shit!" Like, "Oh my god!" And it's basically like calling people out
And you look down and
who
your hands were
don't.
covered with blood.
Right, exactly. Well, and it's really interesting that the game takes time to think of all of the different things that go around making a game where your choices matter. And there, these days, there's a lot of stuff that goes into it. There's romance stuff. There's watching the videos on YouTube so you don't have to do it. There's save files because what if you did something and then decided you didn't like it and then did it again? And it fucks with each one of those things. There's actually a boss battle that's actually a date game. You're on a date. And it plays dating music from like a dating simulator from Japan. It plays the same fucking kind of music, and you have to like get all the meters right, and you have to come up with the right responses. And so it's such a small indie game, and it visually looks like it's really simple, but it is so complex. It's such a complex system. And it totally blew my mind, especially watching the video. Like, God damn it! Like, let me enjoy the evil run. I mean, I was like, you're taking a pot shot at my livelihood. I mean, not that I make any money off of spoiler writing, but like, come on! This is what I do! Oh. But yeah, it's a really great game, and you should go play it. I don't know how long it is. It's not that long, but the boss battles are
Mine was
really tough.
about 8 hours, I think, and I basically did everything to get the true ending.
Even if you don't hurt anyone, even if you don't kill anyone, you still have to do battling. And the battle system's basically, crap, what's that game called? Bullet Hell? Is that right? Maybe.
Yeah.
You have to dodge a bunch of stuff that gets thrown at you, and the things that get thrown at you do damage. So even if you're not in combat, even if you don't want to hurt them, you still have to survive their attacks by moving fast enough and getting away from their attacks.
And then kind of like puzzle through like various actions you can do to figure out like what you have to do to get this person to stop fighting you.
It's better than Soma. You should play it before you play Soma.
This month has been so weird. All these games came out of nowhere. I mean, I knew Soma was coming out, but like the Beginner's Guide was announced.
I'm so swamped.
I know, right? Sub-level zero, too, right, guys? Sub-level zero. You guys know what I'm talking about, right?
I mean, and there's a TF2 update. There's a new TF2 update with, like, new game modes and shit. And, like, that's tough. I have to play that stuff now. And it's pretty fun. You should go play it. But, like, there's just so many games. So many fucking games.
I mean, that's, like, normal for coming up on November. I mean, we're almost halfway through October now. But, like, they're all really good. And they're not AAA games either, for the most part.
Two kitties? Well, don't mind if I do. Oh, sorry.
So, we've talked about video games. Mumbles, do you have your hands full with cats, or can you tell us about your mystery webcomic that you like?
Okay, it's real quick. There's this webcomic that I found because I was running the elliptical today, and I was like, oh, I have a great idea for a new book. It's a hench girl. Like, you know, she's a henchman, but she's a girl. And I was like, I should go online to make sure no one has done this yet. And someone has, and it's great. It's just called Hench Girl Comic. It's a webcomic. It's about this girl who is a real low-level hench girl, and it's awesome, and you should read it with me. And I don't think it's that popular, so you'll be cool if you read it. You can tell all your cool friends that you read this cool webcomic.
I will link it in the show notes.
Yes.
This week, the other game I played is Sub-Level Zero, and I'm the only one to have played it, but it's an indie game. It's an indie game in the style of Descent, which it's been a long time since we've had a Descent clone. For a while there, around the turn of the millennium, it looked like Descent clones were going to be as common as Doom clones. I remember seeing a lot of them. Forsaken's the only one I can remember, but I know there were a bunch of them, and they were all awful, or nobody cares or remembers any of them. They just came and went and are just gone. I remember reading reviews of them. Can't remember what they're called. Don't remember what they looked like or anything. I never played them, never owned them. The entire genre just vanished there. And now an indie has kind of brought it back. And for reference, Descent is you pilot a craft through a... You know, it's like you pilot some sort of, I don't know, hovering, flying machine.
Pilot a spaceship. You're flying a spaceship through a mine, basically.
Through a mine, on the moon. But, you know, there's no definitive way is up. You can roll and you hover all the time. So there's no, like, canonical, this direction is definitely up. Now, in Descent, the artists often did, like, try to arrange things so that if you were in a room, you could tell, okay, the lights are on that surface. On opposite that is this tile. I bet you the tile was the floor and those lights are the ceiling. And Descent was pretty good about keeping those the same from room to room. So there was kind of an up, even if you'd lost track of it during the fights, because you're flipping over and spinning around during fights and flying through tunnels that will, you know, do loop-de-loops and stuff. And so you might lose track of up, but in Descent there was up. In Sub-Level Zero, there is not. And it's actually kind of annoying to me. Like, you'll be in a room, and then you'll go through a door, and the next, very next room has a different natural up orientation suggested by the art, which kind of rubs me the wrong way. But it's procedurally generated roguelike, so it's different every time. You know, permadeath. So when you die, you go back to the beginning and you start over again. But it managed to capture the Descent feel in a really important way. And that's hard to do. Descent is not easy to do. And they did it, and it's a lot of fun. And if you like Descent, then try Sublevel Zero. It's super fun.
But do you have to fight the core over and over again?
Oh, you're right. Yeah, yeah. The end of the level ends with you fighting this big... It's not a reactor core, but in this game, you fight this... You get to a room, and you fight this big thing that defends itself. And when it blows up in Descent, you had to then run away. You had to find an exit and, like, escape the explosion of the reactor core. In this game... You just kill the thing and it creates a gateway to the next zone where you play through. And there's not that many zones, it looks like. I mean, I haven't beaten the game yet. But you just work your way from one to the next and see how far you can go before you die. And you can, like, craft stuff and upgrade your weapons, and you pick up new weapons, and pretty fun, pretty interesting, and manages to get that sort of weird 3D feel where you're kind of rolling and spinning and dogfighting enemies as opposed to simply circle strafing them, which is what you get in far too many games that, you know, end up feeling a little flat, a little two-dimensional. So, that's Sublevel Zero. If you're not already a Descent fan, I'm not sure that it would... I think my enjoyment of this game is entirely nostalgia-based. I don't know that this game would be that enjoyable if you've never gotten into Descent before.
And Descent, like, now, after we've been doing 3D games for 20, 25 years, Descent is sort of very strange...
It is,
like,
strange.
At the time, you know, 1994 or 5, I think, like, we were still kind of figuring out, like, hey, we got 3D games now. How the hell do you control these things? And
yep.
Descent was one of those control schemes that didn't make the cut, which
Descent
doesn't mean it was
game,
bad, but...
Descent is the game that ruined me. It default to using the numpad to move around.
So
you use the numpad, and it's like you use, I think it was enter to move up on the numpad and delete to move down or something like that. And then your WASD was actually, you know, 8, 4, 6, and 2 on the numpad. And then you rolled with the 9 and the 7, and you can just look at the numpad in front of you to get a feel for this. So it's close
if
to
you even have one. I'm sure yeah. People are listening to this on laptops or whatever.
Yeah. Well, you'll just have to picture it in your mind. The point is, it doesn't really map very well to WASD. And so that's how I learned it. So then when I played my next 3D game, which was Quake, I just kept using that system because it was comfortable for me already. And that really ruined me. I used that for like 15 years, and finally it got to the point where games just could not, like, console ports. The more consoleized games became, the less sense they made. With the numpad, like, obviously no QA tester ever tested binding stuff to the numpad. Like, sometimes you couldn't, or the keys were all labeled as unknown, or they were already bound to, like, the in-game chat functions and you couldn't rebind them. And it just became so obnoxious with game. And I finally gave up, and I spent, like, a year just remapping my muscle memory to use WASD. And that really sucked. Oh, that sucked. That might be a big part of the reason I don't play a lot of shooters these days. Like, I don't play many shooters, and I used to be really into shooters, and it could be that that jump just made them a little less satisfying for me. Because even to this day, it always feels a little off. Never feels quite right.
Now all we have to do is to get you to stop using inverted mouse. And we have converted you to every other gamer.
Yeah, and inverted mouse, I've seriously considered. Like, there was a game I ran into earlier this year, just didn't have invert mouse. And I was like, oh, I'll tough my way through it. And, like, after 5 minutes, I was just so pissed off. You can deal with inverted mouse, but a game where you keep opening up an inventory or whatever and then closing it and then opening it and then closing it, it's like every time that happens, it breaks your mental... You know, okay, I'll do everything backwards. And then
Then you go into a menu and you forget to do that. Fuck.
And you come out of the menu and everything's backwards again. And it's just this constant, like, it just really makes you angry. At least it really makes me angry and frustrated. And like, why can't you just put a damn checkbox in this game and multiply the mouse values by -1? That would literally be 5 minutes of work for you. And it would be hours for me to learn to do this properly. And I gave up. I quit the game in disgust. It was just, I wouldn't put up with it. So I think I'm taking that habit to my grave. That I'm just not going to be able to get over that one. That just is too many years of inverted mouse. And for the record, that also came from Descent. Because, you know, Descent, you're flying a craft.
I was wondering. I was like, that seems like something that Descent would have done.
Yep, that was my first quote, mouse look game, is piloting this craft. And so then when I fired up Quake, it felt a little weird. I want to look down, and I naturally push the mouse forward. And so, you know, rather than, at the time, I could have probably saved myself a big headache if I just mentally powered through it and just, like, taught myself that pushing forward on the mouse is to look up. I could have saved myself all these years of frustration with people who are idiots and don't know how to invert the mouse properly. The other mistake is they offer invert mouse, but they invert both axes. Thank you so much, you magnificent dumbass.
Yeah, in what universe would anyone ever want to invert the right-left axis? Like, what?
That was Beyond Good and Evil did that. That was for a joystick still, but when you hit invert mouse, it inverts both axes on the joystick. And it was like, forget it. I played through that entire game with a non-mouse invert because I couldn't invert the controls like I wanted to. Got all the way to the end, and it was really frustrating playing that game where it was always backwards. And then the final boss is a boss where you have to do the WASD part backwards. And I flipped off the screen and I quit the game. So I've never technically beat Beyond Good and Evil. I got to the final boss and then I was done. Done.
This has been another exciting adventure into old man Seamus's weird quirks when playing video games.
Shut up. Shut up. All right. Chris, you wanted to talk about Star Wars Battletoads here? Is that true?
No, Star Wars Battletoads. It's different.
I don't know. Want is such a strong word.
Yeah.
I'm really curious because I've been hearing two things about it, which is meh. And this game is the most awesome thing I've ever played. This is everything I've ever wanted. Well, and
I don't know what the fuck people you've been talking to, but
this is Twitter. This is Twitter. And
yeah,
that could have been sarcasm that I was not parsing because I haven't played the game. And maybe they were like,
I mean, I hope
dealing
so.
With some disconnection issue that everybody was dealing with. And they were sarcastically saying, oh, this is what we've always wanted. So please clear up the confusion. What's going on with Star Wars Battlefront?
I had a fun issue, actually. Camster and I played it the other day, the beta, and I had something similar to a disconnection issue that everyone was having. It wasn't a disconnection issue. It was an issue where I launched the game, and it was a black screen, and nothing happened. And ran around looking for a solution, and it took me like a half an hour of just rolling through Reddit threads of people like, hey, I have this problem, here's a solution. Solution doesn't work. And nobody seemed to know how to fix it. I finally found the solution, and the solution was to install a new install of Origin over itself. And that made it so I could launch the game. So,
Origin! You suck so bad.
I mean, maybe it's because the install might have been from before I switched to Windows 10, and maybe that, like, there wasn't something in the registry was messing it up or something. I don't know. But that's fixed it, and I got to launch Battlefront finally, which might have been a mistake.
I didn't have any actual launching issues. There were, when Josh and I tried to play, weird connection issues in terms of getting our party together. You know, I would invite Josh.
Hey, Chris, I see you in my party. So let's go do party stuff. And then Chris is like, no, you're not in my party. What are you talking about?
Yeah, we had instances where sometimes it looked like I wasn't in his party to me, but it looked like I was in his party to him. Also, they have this weird thing where you can have a party, but that is separate from the partner system. You don't have a squad like in Battlefield that's like three or four guys. You have a partner. You can spawn on one guy. You pick your friend, your one friend, and that is the friend who can spawn on you or that you can spawn on, which is really bizarre.
What if you spawn and your buddy is a dumbass? Or what if he's the most awesome player in the world and you can't keep up with him?
Don't spawn on him. That is the only solution. You can spawn on him or not spawn on him and spawn back at spawn base.
Well, spawn base being wherever the fuck the game decides it wants to drop you this time, because the spawns are like all totally random and sometimes you'll just pop up right in front of the enemy and immediately get killed.
I've seen that happen a few times, yes.
So there were connection issues. I've also had a few random crashes. The game didn't alt-tab well. Josh and I were playing on the PC. It didn't alt-tab well. And then, one time when I quit, it killed my machine with a red screen of death. Like, it had just killed my video driver. Screen was red. Control-delete did nothing.
Whoa! Wow!
Could be my machine. Could be. I mean, I am a sample size of one, so keep that in mind. But it...
Okay,
no other application,
so
red screen of death's
just,
me.
Okay, so just there for everybody, so everybody knows, it will red screen of death everyone's machine. Got it.
It will red ring of death your computer somehow.
Yes, it will do that. No, wait, is this, okay, I honestly don't know anything. I didn't play any previous Battlefront. Is this also on consoles, or is this a PC exclusive?
Yes.
Or what?
Yeah, no, it's on all the consoles except the Wii U,
all of
I
them.
Think so.
But you're not playing with each one is in their own playpen, right? It's not like,
yeah.
It's not like Xbox and PlayStation can play together, because who needs that?
No. Well, there's all sorts of logistics issues in that anyway, because you end up with like having to set up matchmaking services across the networks. And
I know why. It's just, it's always made me sad.
But so once we got into a game, first thing you notice is that the game is like a wet dream of what your 14-year-old self wanted a Star Wars game to look like. Like, Star Wars games have never, ever looked this good. It is really as good as it ever has ever looked. It's amazing.
It looks like they got the id tech, like Rage mega textures stuff, but actually got it to work.
I mean,
like,
it's definitely the ice engine or whatever, the Battlefield engine, but it looks nice. Yeah.
It looks really, really good.
Then you sit down to play it and you start noticing all the little things that don't quite work. Like, the core of the game is Battlefront/Battlefield, right? It's try to complete objectives in a big thing, big open battle
with lots of players, and
but little problems start to pop up. Like, for example, the fact that for some reason, unlike Battlefield, they didn't go with any classes. So it's not like you can hop into an anti-armor class right from the get-go and take out the AT-AT or AT-STs that are causing your team problems. You have to level up to unlock the weapons that give you the ability to tackle the AT-STs. And even in the beta, that means reaching level like 4 or 5 before you can start really effectively combating them. So the first time you play, it's going to be a really frustrating experience, and it's so bad that when you click to go to the main mode, which is like the big 20-on-20 mode that's on Hoth, it's their big set piece that they're using in the beta, they pop up a message that says, hey, you should really go play the other modes and level up before you even try getting into this mode, which to me is just like a clear sign that the game is maybe not designed that well, when they're like, yeah, you can't play the main mode right now. You have to level up to play the main mode.
That's so stupid.
It doesn't keep you from playing the main mode, mind you. It just says that you probably shouldn't.
But then there's the Battlefield problem of you can only change your loadout in between games. You like in Team Fortress, you can go to your setup and change your loadout whenever you want, even if you're not currently playing. Battlefield lets you do it on a website or in between game missions, but never like you can't just load up Battlefield and before you start playing, make sure your loadout is right because you want to play a sniper.
And that's how it was for Splatoon too. Like I don't understand why people don't implement change your loadout whenever you feel like it, because it just makes the game easier for you. Like, for example, if you're like, oh, there's too many of this class, or we're gonna definitely need, I don't know, more bombs or shit, that it's just easier to be like, alright, now I'm gonna put my bombs on, and then you're good to go. Like, it's just so lame to me, and it works great in TF2. It's actually a set piece of TF2, because if your whole team are spies, and the other team have, like, full, like, soldiers and heavies and medics and stuff, you're like, oh, well, maybe we should even this out a little bit more, and then you do, and then it's a fair fight. I don't understand why that isn't a thing.
You can change classes in the middle of the game. It's just, like, only in the middle of the game. Like, it's the opposite problem. Like, take Splatoon's thing and flip it around. Imagine if you can only change your loadout in Splatoon in the middle of a match. That is what Battlefield...
You should be able to do it whenever you want, change what you want your class to be and what your class has. Like, it just doesn't make any sense why that isn't a normal thing for first-person shooters these days. A third-person, too. All the shooters.
And then the final thing that rubs me the wrong way, well, one minor thing, the game has bloom and HDR lighting, which is very, very pretty in screenshots, yes. But on the Hoth level, it makes playing inside of the Hoth base impossible, because if you are inside looking out at snow, it is just blinding white light, and there is no way you can do anything.
You found the portal to heaven! Oh god, they're shooting you through it, you know, it's like, totally, like, the graphics are getting in the way of the gameplay.
And then, like, every single thing in the game is a power-up. Like, it's not like in Battlefield where...
That is one of the most irritating things. This is not just something that is in every other Battlefield game, but it was also in the first two Battlefronts, where you have that sort of Battlefield cliche of everybody wants to get on the helicopter, so they team kill the person who gets the helicopter and end up just fighting over their own helipad, you know, but the vehicles spawn up in the world and you have to go and get in them and drive them around. In Battlefront, you go over to these floating tokens that occasionally respawn, and then that gives you a power-up on your bar that says, like, you have an A-Wing, and then you go and find a place to safely deploy the A-Wing, and then you teleport into it, and you're in the sky flying around. And that's dumb.
And it has to be emphasized that when Josh says teleport into it, what he means is it takes a couple seconds where you kind of hunker down and call the vehicle in, and then you teleport to a completely different part of the map inside of the A-Wing and sort of fly in from outside of the map world. So it's not like you can like strategically grab an AT-ST, walk back behind the enemy base, and then pop an AT-ST and like just start stomping on dudes. You pop the AT-ST and it spawns you outside of the map somewhere where now you're in an AT-ST and you can walk in and start trying to meet objectives. It completely removes all strategy about deploying vehicles other than giving it to you to... Like, I'm trying to figure out why they would do that, right? Because...
Yeah.
Because it's not like you get to hoard them. It's not like you get to strategically use them because it's a use-it-or-lose-it system. If you pick up a TIE fighter, you have something like 30 seconds to actually pop the TIE fighter before it goes back to its spawn point. Someone else has the ability to take it. So it's not like it's giving you the ability to just, like, get shot at and go, oh, I'm going to go TIE fighter just right now. And it also doesn't prevent, hoarding of vehicles or whatever, because you still... I just don't get it.
It's not... That really is something that annoyed me. And, like, the whole Hoth battle is a very strange setup where, you know, in the movies, they sent out snow speeders and they had their ground battle, and then the snow speeders would go and, like, try to take out the AT-ATs before they, blew up the shield generator. And that was how it worked in the other Battlefront games. But in this one, you've got to go and hold objective points, beacons, And if you hold them, Y-Wings will occasionally fly in and bomb the AT-ATs with, like, I don't know, something that makes them vulnerable. And then you've all got to shoot at the AT-ATs with your small arms fire in order to kill them. Or, you know, if you have a rocket launcher, you can do that. And you can fly a snowspeeder, but the AT-ATs are only vulnerable to it when they've been hit by the Y-Wing bombers. And then after the Y-Wing bombers come in and you get your chance to shoot at the AT-ATs, the front gets moved back further into the base, and you've got to hold beacons, like, further back in there to get more Y-Wings. And it's like, why did they set it up this way? This isn't what happened in the movies. This isn't what happened in any of the other games that have done this battle. Why is it so, like, silly?
It's very hard to understand what you're doing. And once you understand it, the game makes more sense. Like, I don't know if you've gone back and played it again, Josh, but I have, and it makes,
I haven't.
It makes more sense once you actually kind of grok what they're going for, which is basically the AT-ATs, there's two of them, they're on a set time to intercept the generators, so each round is a set amount of time, and there are three rounds, and each time a round is over, you move on to the next set of beacons and the next area of the map. So in that way, it's kind of like a TF2 map. And so what you're trying to do is secure the beacons so that each time a beacon is full, it will trigger a Y-Wing. And you want as many Y-Wings as possible, because the more Y-Wings fire at them, the longer the AT-ATs are exposed for each session. So what you want to do is basically... It looks like you're supposed to hold both, right? When you first pop into the game, there are two objective markers for the Rebels that both say activate or defend. And if you've been playing any other game lately, your instinct is just, like, run over and camp them and sit there. But really what you want to do is pick one or the other to basically hold and make sure you get as many Y-Wings as possible. And then once they reach the part where the Y-Wings go, then you can, you know, shoot the AT-ATs. It's stupid and it's confusing, and the real problem is a bunch of user interface stuff in terms of telling the player what's going on, because the game itself doesn't make it super clear what either team is trying to do. And they try to fix that with, like, a pre-game video of, like, here are your objectives, but it's still really confusing. So I've warmed to it somewhat, but it is basically Battlefield Star Wars, and my biggest
concern, a stripped-down version of Battlefield at that.
Well, my biggest concern is that it seems to have the evolve problem of, like, the goal is to grind up through the content of the unlocks, and then after that you're going to be bored to tears. Like, it does not strike me as a game. Like, Battlefield, for all its problems, it was buggy, it had latency issues and netcode issues. It was really good at sort of telling emergent humor stories where, you know, I stayed behind to try to save the point, but then they blew up the whole building, ha ha ha. You know, this game doesn't have stuff like that. There's not a ton of emergent narrative going on in these levels. There's not a lot of destructible buildings. There's not a lot of dynamic level changes. You know, Battlefield was really good at that. And when you take away all that emergent narrative, all you're left with is that Evolve, Call of Duty style, like, well, I guess I got to get all the unlocks and get all the cards or whatever. Okay. Now maybe in the full game that'll be different. Maybe there's going to be more content, more things to do, more levels that feel more emergent than this Hoth thing, but as it stands now, it feels very, very Evolve-y, and that's not a good sign.
So I'm not going to buy it this year. Maybe discount goes on sale. Probably not, though.
Really, it just makes me want another game in that engine, because it's so gorgeous. It really is gorgeous, but... all you do is shoot. It's like
KOTOR 3 in that engine or something.
Well, seriously, we're doing KOTOR now, and, like, KOTOR is, like, this vibrant reality that looks like it's from 1998, and then you go and play Battlefront, and it's, like, this plastic stage front where there's no depth to it, but it looks amazing, and I'm like, I want this peanut butter to mix with this chocolate. I want a good game.
All right. Well, I'm not going to get it either.
Mumbles, it's up to you.
Are you gonna get it, Mumbles?
I have this great new computer. I need a cool game to play it. I wish it was great so I could play it on my cool new computer. Sweet new rig.
In no time at all, you're going to have all the Fallout 4 to play that you could possibly want.
That's true. Yeah, but Fallout 4 looks like it was made in 2009. Who cares?
Oh, it's never going to look good.
All right. I think that's enough show for tonight.
Seamus, you were supposed to talk about Kerbals.
Oh, yeah.
I have a question.
All right.
If one Kerbal grabbed another Kerbal's nipple and twisted it, would it be a Kerbal Nurple?
That is a profound question, you ass.
Good night, everybody!